Good afternoon. This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order. The time is 3:16 p.m. on March 6. Members present are Representative Carrick, Representative Coulombe, Representative Freer, Representative Sadler, myself, Co-Chair Hall. We are expecting Co-Chair Fields to join online at some point, but I don't see him available presently. We are asking, we do have a quorum. Please silence your cell phones. We're asking that staff and members of the audience not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Joan Wilkerson, and she will take care of it. I'd like to thank Andrew Magnuson, the Labor and Commerce Committee Secretary, and Jude Augustine from the Juno LIO for tech and teleconferencing support. We have a single item on the agenda today, and that is HJR 38 regarding public safety telecommunicators, sponsored by my office. This is the first hearing of this bill, and we will hear invited testimony. My aide, Maya Narang, will present the bill. Ms. Narang, please take a seat in the front of the room, introduce yourself for the record, begin your presentation, and I'd want to give just a brief overview of what HJR 38 does before officially handing it over to Ms. Narang. But basically, HJR 38 is a resolution urging Congress to pass the enhanced the Enhanced First Response Act, which basically there's a provision in that act that will reclassify public safety telecommunicators, also known as emergency dispatchers, to be reclassified under basically a first responder status. Currently, they are classified as clerical or administrative, and that inhibits them from having the same or similar access to benefits that their first responder colleagues are have access to. So with that, I will hand it over to Ms. Narang for her presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the committee, I am Maya Narang, staff to Representative Paul. HJR 38 does two things. It urges the United States Congress to recognize public safety telecommunicators, more commonly known as emergency dispatchers, as first responders, and urges Congress to pass the Enhancing First Response Act or similar legislation. The resolution highlights that our emergency dispatchers are the first responders, providing the first communication in the first responder system, and are critical to our law enforcement, firefighters, and medical responders in the field. The work our emergency dispatchers do has a profound effect on the outcomes of the many calls they respond to. Our emergency dispatchers may endure psychological effects, which, compounded with limited or no avenue for closure post-incident, may lead to post-traumatic stress disorder. Currently, under the Federal Standard Occupational Classification System, our emergency dispatchers are classified as clerical workers. This limits their ability to access training and grant opportunities, wellness resources, and enhanced retirement benefits alongside their first responder colleagues. Given the nature of their work and the critical role they play in the first responder system, reclassifying them as first responders is the first step towards recognizing the importance of their work. The Enhancing First Response Act, Senate Bill 725, was co-sponsored by Senator Dan Sullivan, and passed the U.S. Senate last year, when we urged the U.S. House of Representatives to swiftly pass this legislation and recognize the importance of our emergency dispatchers.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Narang. Do committee members have any questions at the moment? If not, we will turn to invited testimony. I also want to note for the record that Representative and Co-Chair Fields joined the committee via Teams at 3:17 p.m. Do we have any questions from the committee? Was that a representative?
No, just listening to see if he was there, but I said yes. I'll raise my hand and ask a brief question, please.
Representative Sadler.
Through the chair, Mr. Narang, in reading through the resolution, I'm not familiar with the federal government's labor classifications, and the sponsor and co-chair made some reference to what it would mean for people who are telecommunications first providers. Would that change their retirement benefits availability? Could they retire in 20 years like a firefighter or a police officer does?
Through the chair, to Representative Sadler. I believe it does open some opportunities for differences in what they currently receive, but this is a federal classification, and I believe the federal classification and what we offer in our state statutes are not exactly the same. I would have to get back to you with the exact information on what retirement benefits they could receive, but I believe there's two different avenues on that sort of determine what that is. And I can get that information and provide it to the committee.
I suspect it'll be developed as we debate the bill. So I suspect that the answer will come as we discuss the bill, so I'll hang on.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Looking online for invited testimony, I see Aaron Kalwara, the public safety manager with the Juneau Police Department. Would you please put yourself on the record and provide your testimony? Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Yes, I'm Aaron Kalwara, public safety manager at the Juneau Police Department. In my career, I've held multiple roles related to public safety. I started as a public safety dispatcher in 1999. I was a communication training officer, emergency medical dispatch instructor, a lead dispatcher, and was the 911 coordinator for the city and borough of Juneau for a number of years. In my current role, I manage multiple units, including the 24/7, 365-day-a-year operations of our communication center, which is staffed by public safety dispatchers and call takers. Part of that is just ensuring that our police and fire radio system is up and working. Part of it is actually hiring, training, and retaining staff, and just ensuring that we're meeting standards that we have internally with our policies, procedures, and national standards. I'm on the Joint State Board for the Association of Public Safety Communications Officials and the National Emergency Number Association. Those are two nonprofit organizations that provide standards for public safety dispatching and 911 operations and technical issues. I'm here just to testify that public safety dispatchers and call takers are not clerical staff. They're not clerical workers. They answer 911, they answer other emergency calls for service, and many lives have been saved because of our 911 professionals, our dispatchers, our call takers, their dedication to public safety and serving the communities that they live in and sometimes places that they don't live. They, in my opinion, definitely are the first of the first responders who assist individuals who are in crisis, and they play a very, very vital role in every emergency. There are very few emergencies that do not start with a call to 911 or to a 10-digit line answered by somebody who's trained to answer emergency calls for service. Our staff in our comm center also hold licenses from the State of Alaska Department of Health and Emergency Medical Services as EMDs, emergency medical dispatchers. So we have state licenses for these people, just recognizing that just like a paramedic or an EMT level person, that there are standards that they must meet. There's training, there's continuing education. And I think that those things bode well to say that this is absolutely a profession. It's not just a job. Part of the job that I just want to share from my perspective is that most dispatchers in Alaska are jack of all trades. They're multidisciplinary. Some work just for law enforcement or just for medical, but many do process calls for service for police, medical, fire, search and rescues, mobile crisis teams, mobile integrated health. These things are just expanding time and time again. I mean, every year we're picking up more work. We're picking up more technologies, and we're working with more partners like 988 now in Alaska. Our dispatchers use technical systems, very, very technical systems. 911, our phone systems, our GIS and mapping systems. We have computer-aided dispatch. These are things that are very unique to our field. They're very difficult to use, and they have to use them so well that they can do it without thinking or looking. They take a call, they listen, they use these systems, they get the information out there. Our firefighters, our police officers, our medics depend on this information to be absolutely accurate, basically perfect, when it goes out over the air and over the technical systems like fire station alerting. Keeping up with that technology is very different. Our systems change very frequently, and it's not just a clerical or reception type of task. They have to be a master of all of those systems. In addition to that, the systems and technology that the public uses, like wireless phones, cell phones, changes a lot. So our public safety dispatchers have to be aware of how these systems work, how they interact. If they have somebody on the phone and they don't know where they're at, they don't know how to turn on their GPS, our dispatchers start working on that with them. They figure things out and they help them with their own technologies. You guys hopefully have never had to call 911 or talk to a dispatcher. If you haven't, I love that. That's great. But if you ever do need them, I want you to know that we train our people to be professional, to be courteous, and they have to be, they are ready to answer any call for service. It could be a barking dog. It could be a parking complaint. It could be CPR in progress. It could be a very traumatic injury. It could be a suicidal person. I have worked with people who have been on the phone with somebody who committed suicide while they were on the phone with them. I have worked with people who've helped with bystander CPR on infants who have died. I've worked with people in the comm center right next to them as they're taking a call from two survivors of a plane crash where multiple people in the plane crash did not live. They are helping provide them with medical instructions so they can sustain their lives. And it was a very remote location. It took us, I want to say, at least 3 hours to get to them to find their location. So they were constantly pinging using technology, just advocating for the people and helping them stay calm. And after you take those calls, you walk away with that with a lot of stress, like any other first responder. You hold that in. You have to finish your shift. You have to come back the next day, and you have to work through all this. So those things are very, very different than what people perform in the clerical field, in my opinion.
Thank you, Ms. Kawara, for your testimony. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Kawara? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Kawara. Is there much, often people work for the state of Alaska and some will shift over into federal service. I guess just in the scope of the resolution, a really simple thing. This standard occupational classification covers federal telecommunications workers and state telecommunications workers. This is not simply a federal workforce issue. Is that correct?
I'm not sure if I'm understanding your question, so I'll just my knowledge, and Stephanie or someone else on the call may know a little bit more. This is a federal issue, in my opinion. All comm centers in the United States are struggling with retention. They're struggling with hiring. They're struggling with training. They're struggling with training budgets. It's not isolated to my community. It's not isolated to Alaska. It's a federal issue. There are dispatchers that work at a local level. We have dispatchers that work in rural areas in Alaska. We have people in larger cities in Alaska. We have people, I've been in classes before with federal dispatchers who work in the Federal Park Service. So the job can be a little bit different everywhere, but some of the primary duties are very same. You accept a call for service, you process it, you help the person, you get a responder to them.
Follow-up?
Yeah, just probe that a little. So through the chair, Ms., my question, I guess, is kind of, so you say it's a federal issue. I'm just trying to scope this out. What the resolution is seeking to do is to encourage Congress to adopt a federal law. Would that federal law change classifications for telecommunications workers, first responders in Alaska? Is this a national reclassification? Would this affect state workers, is my question.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, good.
Yes,
job.
Sir.
Okay.
Yes, yes. I understand now. Sorry about that.
Thanks.
Okay. Seeing no further questions from the committee, thank you for your time and your testimony, Ms. Kawara. If you're able to stay on the line and answer potential future questions, we'd appreciate it, but I recognize that you may have time constraints on your schedule.
No worries, I'm available.
Thank you. Next in the queue, we will go to Stephanie Wolf, who's one of the lead dispatchers with the Anchorage Fire Department. Ms. Wolf, will you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony? And Ms. Wolf, if you're speaking, you're...
Sorry about that.
Oh, there you are.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can,
Hi.
Ms. Wolf.
Hi. My name is Stephanie. I'm one of the lead dispatchers for the Anchorage Fire Department Dispatch. And I want to thank you for allowing me to provide my testimony today in support of HJR 38. So I've worked as a public safety telecommunicator for 18 and a half years for the Anchorage Fire Department, or the AFD. We are also licensed EMDs from the state. And we also go through a training program through paramedics, teach us about the body, that what makes you sick versus not sick. We also have captains come in and explain us the fire program, the protocol. So when we triage these calls, we have a working knowledge of the system, as well as the radio systems, with our NG. We are part of the IZINET phone system, which is a very high-tech phone system where we have to know how to operate that, as well as work on the new radios and simultaneously do those proficiently so the responders that are going to the calls get the information fast. So one of the first things is, think that reclassifying public safety telecommunicators from clerical workers to protective service operations on a federal level has long been overdue. And so one of the first questions is, like, why should we support the Enhancing First Act, or S-725? So reclassifying over 100,000 911 professionals as protective workers is a more accurate reflection of the work that we do. Some states and localities have recognized their public safety telecommunicators as first responders, acknowledging that their service to the community is more clerical. However, a federal reclassification as protective workers will have a consistent category for every state and territory in the union. The S-725 would create a consistent database for the federal government to collect accurate data to reflect the increasing PTSD and chronic emotional trauma and help improve the 911 system. S-725 passed the Senate unanimously, and now it's waiting in the House for a vote. And so the next question is, like, what is the fiscal note attached to it? There's absolutely no dollars. This is a zero fiscal note bill. Safety telecommunications are one of the first point of contacts when a citizen needs help. So keep in mind that we have no idea what's on the other end of the phone call until we say or ask you, what are you reporting? We have to be ready to make quick decisions in a dynamic environment that can have either a positive or negative impact on patient outcomes. And some of these calls and decisions can weigh heavily on our mental health months or years later. We are trained to triage and provide pre-arrival instructions from critical to non-critical calls. And I'll give some examples. CPR, childbirth, how to administer an AED, choking victims, seeking vehicles, person on fire, trapped in a structure fire, burns, tourniquet application, seizures, diabetic crisis, allergic reactions, avalanche, mudslides, structure collapse, swift water rescue, electrical hazards, hazmat problems, gas leaks, train incidents, water rescues, mental health problems, front country rescues, industrial entrapments, that's just to name a few. So imagine answering the phone only to hear a distraught mom screaming that her baby is not breathing. The first thing we have to do is confirm the address. Gain control, only using our voice, and then calmly walk through this person through telecommunicator CPR or TCPR. When a person is that distraught, they go into fight or flight. We know that time is crucial in this scenario and that we are dispatching people out simultaneously, but the caller doesn't understand that and they see us as a barrier. This is where we have to use words and phrases to reel the caller in to keep them engaged and compliant with pre-arrival instructions. As a professional, we have to understand that this is not our emergency. However, we are human beings and caregivers by nature. So we have to remember not to get emotionally involved, because we have to make sure that we're helping the caller and give them the right pre-arrival instructions. Throughout my career, I've taken hangings, gunshot wounds, violent sexual assaults, overdoses, wives coming home to find their husbands dead after going shopping, horrific traffic accidents, babies not breathing, structure fires with entrapments. One call that has stayed with me over the years was a bear mauling that happened 16 years ago on Bicentennial Trail when I was in training. Unfortunately, our system was a lot different back then, where we were able to maybe ping you a little bit on the map, but we never had the trail overlay on the map to know where you really were. So unfortunately, that was a time where I felt completely helpless and abandoned by our tools. I was thankful that the coach that found this poor girl was very knowledgeable of the area. It's about a 25-minute phone call, and it was heartbreaking to hear him comfort this girl, saying it's going to be okay, and then worrying if the bear was going to come back and attack him. During that process, though, our center was creating and coordinating the police, troopers, notifying the hospital of significant injuries that the patient sustained. I honestly have a lot of residual emotions from that call. It's been 16 years, and that is the single reason why I'm so adamant that our CAD map, when I say CAD map, our computer-aided map, has accurate things. If there's not an address on it, that's right. I am very big on getting with our graphic integration system coordinators and making sure that that address point needs to be in there. Or why isn't that overlay showing that that specific trail is on there? Because the location is the single most important piece of information we can get from you. As a supervisor, also, we oversee our fellow members and responders. We are aware of the type of calls they take and watch the mental toll it can take on them, which actually impacts us as well. I've watched my public safety telecommunicator stay on the phone for over 15 minutes to find a person that was trampled by a moose, trying to give them pre-arrival instructions, and then trying to help the wounded. I watched another public safety telecommunicator's demeanor change after directing TCPR on a small child that was a victim of a horrific traffic accident. When the bystander was doing CPR, he was keep saying, "Come on, buddy, come on, buddy." After witnessing this incident, it's hard not to project the horror and sadness in your personal life. Many times after these calls, we'll call our families up and say, "I just want to know that you're okay." It's hard not to take that step off. Adding to the call type trauma, we also have a staffing shortage issue. We are still expected to provide the same level of service with less people. Regardless of the staffing shortage, the calls still come in the center. It is hard to keep calm when the workload continues to increase with no light at the end of the tunnel. It's hard to take care of our crew when the center is inundated. On any given day, we could take back-to-back calls ranging from a person not breathing to a structure fire to a publicly intoxicated person. We have no time to compose ourselves to quickly answer the phone to the next call in queue. What's hard about that is keeping your composure. And also, adding to the staffing crisis, if a person calls out sick, we could be mandated to work up to 18 hours. Are the calls always sad? No, they're not always sad, and then the endings aren't always sad. So the positive things about what we do and the professionals that we provide and the outcomes that help with our, that positive outcomes that we give with our patients is, I met a survivor's wife that told me that she wanted to meet the person that empowered her to take her 250-pound husband off the couch, get him on the ground, and start CPR, and he is alive and well today. Also, I'm in consistent contact with another cardiac arrest survivor that refers to us as his angels. One of my longest friends in Alaska, he just had a Colorado hospital cardiac arrest about a month ago, and he's alive. I had dinner with him the other day. Those are the things that we do. That's not clerical. We were giving them CPR instructions. What I provided is one aspect of the job. We are also lifelines to our firefighters, paramedics, mobile care team, and battalion chiefs, public information officer, private ambulance services, anchored safety patrol. And if you don't know what that is, that's a van that picks up publicly intoxicated people and takes them somewhere safe. And that's just to name a few. Their scene safety is the most important thing when we dispatch them to a call. And we must be ready also to make quick decisions in a dynamic environment. Sometimes we're also on the phone. I was monitoring structure fire when one of our firefighters asked for the law enforcement red lights and sirens because he walked into a room and a guy had a gun in his face. Although it's not a normal incident, we must be ready for that type of that situation. That is not clerical. I had one of our mental health clinicians, her name is Dr. Jennifer Pierce, provide me some peer-reviewed data that compares what we endure as public safety personnel dispatchers to the general public. And then I'll talk to you about also what the line, as in law enforcement, peace officers, and firefighters go through. So compared to the general population, we are 15% more apt to report PTSD. We are 20% more than the general public to report depression. We are 7% more with suicidal ideations, and we are 30% more for hazardous drinking. Our statistics actually mirror what the law enforcement, peace officers, EMTs, and paramedics. That is proof that we sustain the same trauma that they have. That is not clerical. We do need the protection and the recognition as well. Since we are classified as clerical, we have to work 30 years to qualify for retirement or be able to pull money, like in the statewide, out of our HRA. We are, and a lot of times we've had people compare us to air traffic controllers who qualify for a specialized pension allowing retirement at age 50 with 20 years of service, or at any age with 25 years of service, mandatory retirement at 56. I feel, and to a point, we do deserve the same respect and for the service that we provide to the community and be able to enjoy a dignified retirement after servicing our community. The first 911 call occurred in 1968 in Alabama, where the person answered the phone, dispatched law enforcement, and then hung up the phone. We have demonstrated how our jobs have evolved over time, and we don't just answer the phone anymore. We are the first incident command before the units go on location. We are the first responder. I do appreciate you listening to my testimonial, and I invite you all to the Anchorage Fire Department to see how we do, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Do committee members have any questions for Ms. Wolf? Representative Coulomb?
Yeah, through the chair, Ms. Wolf, can you tell me, and maybe you don't know exact statistics, but is the history of this profession in right now dominated by women?
That is a good question. I can't say that for a fact. I want to say yes, but I don't have an exact number on that. But I would say that's easier. I would say a higher yes, but I don't know, the percentage of women to men.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Wolf, just a couple of scoping questions. Again, this is not, luckily, thank God, I've not had to deal much with 911. Is this kind of emergency dispatch, is this handled on a department-by-department basis? Is there a statewide dispatch center? Does the Department of Public Safety do it? Help me understand the management structure of the 911 centers.
Each area has their own 911 response area. So, you know, when we dispatch for the Anchorage Fire Department, the Anchorage Police Department are the primary 911 phone call answerers, and they answered in the geographical area from the Palmer alternate all the way down to Girdwood, a little bit, and then that area is their area. So it depends where your cell phone tower hits, and then it'll hit in that area. So Fairbanks may have their own area. Juneau may have their own area. It just depends what the phone system is set up as.
Very good. Thank you.
Follow up.
And what is the staffing structure? So the one for Anchorage is located in Anchorage, or is it up in the valley at Palmer?
So the Anchorage Fire Department, we are located off of 80th and Homer, 70th. We're clearly attached to Fire Station 12. And we have 22 positions. So we have four leads, and then we have 18 dispatchers. And we're in the process of hiring two more. We have, unfortunately, we don't have everybody out of training right now, so we're kind of short-staffed, but we're working on that as well. Law enforcement, I can't tell you what there is, but we do have a minimum staffing on the day shift and night shift, and if we don't hit that, then we have to mandate people to come in if they're not willing to come in.
Okay.
Follow-up, Representative
Sadler. If I may unpack a little bit of that, Ms. Wolf. So you said that APD is the primary, but you described the Anchorage Fire Departments with 22 positions.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, so there are two different centers serving Anchorage?
Yeah.
One police and one
so
fire?
So the police, that is correct. The police, they handle all of the 911. They initially answer the 911 calls, and if it's fire or medical in nature, they send it to us. And then we handle the rest of it.
I missed the first. So if the 22 positions at the fire department, how many at the police department doing this?
You know, I wouldn't be able to tell you what the police department, I know they are staffed more than we are, but I don't know what their staffing model is.
Okay. And
follow up?
You said that there's the differentiation of four leads and 18 dispatchers in the fire department's center. Would all 22 positions be affected by this reclassification that the resolution is encouraging at the federal level?
They would be. And if you mean like they'll be considered into the protective work? Just making sure I'm understanding your question correctly.
Through the chair, would all of the staff be reclassified?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Nobody will be left behind. No.
Further questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Representative Sadler?
If Ms. Wolf, if you help me understand, what's the pay scale right now for dispatchers and leads? Help me understand this, what we're talking about here.
The pay difference between a lead and a dispatcher is 10%. And I believe I'd have to get our union book and to confirm it. I believe our dispatchers make about $43 an hour. And there's a couple steps in between until they get off of their probation and then the year after probation, and then we're 10% higher.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Okay.
You're welcome.
Okay. Oh, Representative Carrick?
Ms. Wolf, I just wanted to, through the chair, I just wanted to really thank you for the work that you do. I don't quite know how these things always get out, but I've actually heard the transcript of you responding to the Bicentennial North event. And I'm familiar with that because I grew up in Anchorage, and I'm really familiar with that specific mauling incident. And
it was horrible. Yeah. And that was played in the news because of our lack of knowledge for the area. It still impacts me today, like you can see. It really bothered me because I was looking at the map and there was nothing on it because the trails weren't there. And I'm not saying it's anybody's fault. I'm just saying what we had at the time didn't help me. And I'm sitting there, this guy found this poor kid, got mauled by a bear and she was dying. And you feel so helpless when you're trying to, and they were, you know, you're trying to get to stop the bleeding, but thank goodness he was calm under pressure and that made national news. But it was just one of those things where, man, I don't ever want anybody to feel like that again. I don't want somebody to feel that abandoned. I want them to know that we're going to give you the tools that will make you successful because we're professionals, but it's hard to get funding because we're not first responders. So certain we can't get certain, like the Stafford Act. There's things we can't get access to. We can jump onto a fire station maybe, but you have to have a type of grant writer. So it'd be nice to be able to get our own money, to get our own training, to get the top of the line equipment because I can watch my groceries being delivered, right? But it's really hard to find you. And that's our goal, is to make 911 for professionals, life for death. And we just want to make sure that we're getting the type of equipment that represents the work we do.
Well, I would just say through the chair that you are also the hero in that situation, because I heard that transcript, like I said, and he might have been on scene and providing that initial response, but it really is an incredible showcase of what the dispatcher is doing in that emergency situation. And it's a really thank you for what you did there and for your career. It's hard for me to even imagine what kinds of calls you and your colleagues take and how difficult that is.
Thank you. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Representative Sadler has another question.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Are dispatchers in the Anchorage Fire Department represented? Are they organized a group of employees?
We are. We are part of the International Association of Firefighters Union. We're part of the IAFF.
Very good. And follow-up?
Follow-up.
Are there any provisions? I assume, therefore, there's a contract between the employees and the fire department?
We do have a contract binding agreement with the city, with us, and we just got it. Yeah, it's a three-year contract that just got sent, or that just got approved at the beginning of this year. Yeah, they negotiate a contract every 3 to 5 years. I believe it's 3 years now.
And
follow-up?
Thank you. And are there any provisions in those contracts for any special counseling or therapy to help deal with the stresses? I mean, the current situation we have right now, those stresses still exist. So are there any provisions in the contract for those now?
We are lucky to have, we have a peer support group, and we also have Soldier's Heart that we can attend. And we also have, with the Municipality of Anchorage, employee assistance programs. So but we do have an actual peer support team that if you need help, we have chaplains that come and can talk to you as well.
I'm sorry, so a peer support group and Hearts of Angels?
Mm-hmm. Oh, Soldier's Heart.
Soldier's Heart.
And we get invited, yes. And it's a program that I can have, I mean, I can't do the best talk about it, but they do have like a, and somebody else can probably talk better about this, but it's like a retreat that you go to. And I think you just learn how to process some of the trauma that you've endured. It doesn't have to be with the job. It could be just life that can impact how you are in the world. But it's a retreat you can go to. And then, like, the chaplains come by, and you can always call them over, and they come by, and you can have a nice conversation with them.
But my question was, are there any, thank you. My earlier question was, are there any formal provisions in the contract to pay for therapy or counseling?
Not in our contract binding agreement.
Very good. Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, seeing no further questions from the committee, thank you very much for your time, Ms. Wolf. And if you also wouldn't mind just staying online just in case there are future questions. Next up in the queue, we have Julie Condell, lead dispatcher, another lead dispatcher for the Anchorage Fire Department. Ms. Condell, will you please put yourself on the record and provide your testimony?
Hi, my name is Julie Condell. I'm a lead dispatcher for the Anchorage Fire Department. And I appreciate you guys taking your time today to listen to us. I have been with the Anchorage Fire Department for 19 and a half years now, and about 10 of that has been as a lead dispatcher, actually more now. So I am also on the board of directors for Anchorage Firefighters Charitable Foundation, and I'm on our peer support team as well. And we've gone through so many different iterations of training over the years, and it's constantly evolving and making sure that we're doing the best for our teammates as well as ourselves throughout that process. We're a state of Alaska dispatchers, emergency medical dispatchers trained. We have CPR training as well as medical and fire training as well as we go through, plus several of the supervisors, Steph and myself, are APCO fire trainers as well on that side that we do yearly. So it's really interesting being here because my daughter, I have several kids, I have four kids, and my 8-year-old asked, she's like, Mom, why are you coming here to talk about this today? You guys already are first responders. She's like, you're the first responders. And that is something that I've always taught my children. It's something we've always talked about within the realm of the work we do, because we don't do just normal clerical work. As supervisors, we have work in that field that we do, but there's so much of a vast difference between the work side of it that we do and the actual 911 calls we take. I still remember my first like massively traumatic call when I was just in training, and a mother calling about her baby not breathing and her baby's dead, and I'm having to try to calm her down, get the location, and then go through that process of trying to help her before we get there. And you can feel completely fine and control in a call. And once that phone hung up, I remember I started shaking, and I felt like I couldn't breathe, and I didn't understand that. I was like, what's happening? I was like, this is interesting. My trainer immediately came, took me away from the console, talked to me. I was like, this is what's going to happen. This is your very first call. This is like an introduction to the type of calls that you can take. And it's not like we get any type of a heads up. You get an email in your system, right? It tells you the subject line. It's not like a 911 call comes up and it says, incoming, bear mauling, incoming. You're about to send a 16-year-old girl in to see her mother hanging, traumatize her, to see if you can save her mother. You have no idea what's going on. So at any point, it could be a very mild, easy call. Someone slipped out on the ice and you're trying to help them, to someone is deceased and you're seeing if you can revive them. And through this process of these calls that we take, it has taken its toll on people. And I've seen that a lot throughout the years. It's one of the reasons I became a member of our peer support team, because it's been almost 2 years now that I had to listen to two people die in a fire. And I remember like that slide that I took of starting to think about all the calls I've taken and how it felt to listen to that and the subsequent PTS that came from a call such as those. And we deal with those all the time. And as a supervisor, something that Steph spoke about is it changes the whole level of that. Not only are we having to try to take care of ourselves and make sure what we're doing, plus we have to watch our team. We have to be in charge about what's happening throughout the city at that point. And then you have to recognize that same thing within your teammates. Like, are they just taking a bad call? Is that a normal call? Is it something that you have to stop and take that pause? Do they need something that you can't provide? There are times in the center between earthquakes, between wildfires, between windstorms, that there are times that you could be sitting there for 4 hours, not even being able to get up to use the bathroom, get a glass of water, things that seem like basic and routine that you should be able to do anywhere. The board was, we have a sound that bonks if incoming 911 calls are still sitting there and everyone's on 911 calls, it starts bonking at you. So you have that constant pressure of, I need to get off the phone and get to the next emergency and to the next one and to the next one. And there's times when there's huge disasters or the workload is increased so dramatically that you have to switch gears from one to the next to the next. And simultaneously while you're doing that, you're also listening to your crews, you're having a multitasking level that's unparalleled in any other profession that you work in, and you're taking radio channels too. So you're listening to a structure fire where you're making sure your crews are safe and if they need anything, and then you're listening to someone scream on the phone because their kid's in a seizure. And we span a huge span. We deal with Chugach, we deal with Girdwood, we deal with Anchorage Safety Patrol, we deal with all the private ambulances in town, we talk to both of the airports, we talk to all the hospitals, we talk to the police department, and we talk to police departments from other communities as well. Whittier, Valdez now dispatches for Whittier, so we have to talk to both of those places. We have to talk to MATCOM. If something is close enough to the border, we have to transfer things over. If something's close to the border for J-Bear, we're dealing with that. Or like I said, like Steph said, our calls range from something minor to something severe. I mean, I could be providing dispatch-assisted CPR instructions. I can't even tell you over my career how many of those I've done. And because of that, I saved someone's life 8 years ago when him and his partner wanted to meet me. And we're still friends to this day. He still comes in, he still visits. We speak at resuscitation conferences together and give that insight of what it means. And if you're thinking even a 5 minute gap, 8 minute gap, 10 minute gap, if nothing's happening in that span of time and you just call, you write down their information, okay, somebody needs an ambulance, you hang up the phone. Someone's not breathing. It's not like they're suddenly going to start breathing. They're bleeding out. All these massive amount of pre-arrival instructions we have to give them. Bleeding instructions, CPR instructions. I've delivered 3 children over my career and had to get creative, like in a garage, finding a place for a mother to lay down on a luggage rack, you know, making sure to get everything in place to not only preserve current life, but life is coming in. And it's quite a process. And just between 2024 and 2025, our center has seen a 12,000 call increase in 1 year. I can tell you there was parts of this last year you would want to leave work and just breathe or cry or any one of those emotions in between, because you're so completely drained that maybe you haven't ate for 6 hours because you literally can't get up because there's not enough staffing, there's not enough people, and the calls are still coming in. I've literally sat there and taken 3 radio channels and listened to 911 calls so my call taker can go run to go to the bathroom and come back and take another one of those channels back from us. This is stuff that happens all the time to us, and it doesn't stop. I mean, I've taken phone calls. I've had 2 of my longest phone calls. One, I was on a phone call for 3 to 4 hours with a kid, And another one was a bear mauling call I took last year, which was almost an hour and a half call. And during that whole time, it's me and her and trying to keep her awake, trying to keep her alive, making sure she doesn't bleed out, making sure she doesn't move. What was that noise? Is that the bear coming back? And then just that release of emotions when they finally get there and I hear one of my partners, I hear his voice, you know, standing above her, and I can just, like, thank God, like, someone's finally there. Like, someone's going to get her in a helicopter, going to get her to the hospital where she needs to go. And the calls like that, they just never stop. And like I said, you don't get any type of a heads up for what you do. Your family doesn't get a kind of heads up of what type of person's going to walk in the door at any given time. Like I said, I very highly speak out for therapy for our field, for really addressing things like PTS, because it's something that's real and it's something that affects not only you, but affects your family. And it's really hard sometimes as a supervisor, and we're captain level, Steph and I are captains of our crew, to take that hat off sometimes and like reimmerse yourself into real regular life. Normal life, you know, it's not, I sit there looking out our window sometimes think people pass by all day long doing their normal day-to-day activities. And we just listened to a mother scream because she found her daughter committed suicide, her teenage daughter. And talk about a sound that you're never, ever in your entire life going to rid yourself of. You will always remember what that sounded like. And although I feel like any job in this world is valuable, it's what we do is not clerical work, not in any scope of imagination of what it happens. We're constantly having to move, to think about things, to readjust, to talk to multiple people, to correct situations, and to try our best to preserve life. And we are the ones doing that until someone else arrives on location and takes over. There is no one else in that process that's helping with that situation. We are that person. And it's valuable, and it can feel great, and you have moments where it felt like you won. And then you hang up the phone, and then you get the next one, and it feels like everything out of your body's been drained. And it's, and you have to switch quickly from one to the next. And I love the opportunities I've been given in this field. And at the same time, it's taken a lot away from each one of us, and it will continue to do so. So I really appreciate you guys listening to what I had to say. And if you have any questions about anything, I'm happy to talk about anything further.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Condell. Do committee members have questions for Ms. Condell? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Ms. Condell, I appreciate your passionate description of the work, and my heart goes out to you and to the people you deal with. The question arises to me, have we set up a system, you know, technology advances and humans are expected to catch up or keep up. Have we set up a system in which the duties of the work have just become too great to do? I mean, I don't know if more people would help. I think obviously more resources would help, but are we asking too much of one person to do in a dispatching situation, to be the coordination as well as the first responder, as well as the emotional support, all the different things you described so eloquently? Are we asking too much of you? Sincerely.
I mean, at any given moment, can it be too much? Yes, but that's when training comes in handy, and that's when staffing comes in handy, and that's when everything else that builds up that layer of that cake is what creates a better system. Because when the system doesn't have enough people to support it, and we're saying we're drowning here, we had over 600 calls within a 24-hour period, and there's not enough people to support that, but you still have to answer the phone, you still have to do it. It's a system that sometimes it is too much, but you still have to push through, and you have to hit that endpoint, and you still have to get your job done. Mm-hmm. So is it too much sometimes to put on people? Yeah, absolutely, but it's the same thing. If a hospital is completely inundated and overworked and someone comes in with multiple gunshot wounds, the doctor still has to stop and still has to try to save that person too. Yeah. It's a lot of pressure, and it's one that I feel that our crews constantly rise to the occasion, but it still happens day after day.
Follow up. And thank you for that. And I appreciate your perspective. Sometimes it can be too much, but not always. The analogy was drawn between dispatching work and air traffic controllers. I know that controllers get some certain mandated breaks, but they may be held over against their will to do longer overtime. What is the work schedule like normally for a dispatcher? You work 5/8 or 3/10 or, you know, 4/10 or? Yeah, go ahead.
The work is never done till the work is done and it's never done. So, I mean, how it works is for our schedule for the fire department is we work 12-hour shifts. One week we work 3 12s, and the next week we work 4 12s. And then there's four silo shifts. So there's four supervisors, and we work 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., and then 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. And within those crews, that's how it supposedly works. But if someone's not, like right now, where our minimum staffing is supposed to be 22 people, we really desperately need 24 people for our center, and we're working on getting those numbers up. But within that, we have, you know, I can say technically we have 20 people, but we don't. We have one of those individuals that are in our training, and so we're really down to 19, which pushes multiple of these shifts and heavy shifts, especially on days that are incredibly busy. Steph's a day shift lead, I'm a day shift lead, and the call volume is very drastic between days and nights, and we are not properly staffed for it. We don't have enough people, and so what happens is once someone calls out sick, then that's when those shifts expand. You're working a 16-hour shift, you're working an 18-hour shift, and then we also do our best for each other when people need time off for their families to try to cover for one another and to make sure that we're filling in those holes, because there are times that some of us are going to work longer days. We're not going to work 3 days in a row. We're going to work 12 days in a row. Steph can raise her hand on that one. I can raise my hand on that one. It happens. And so when you do get those days off, they're very valuable and needed. But then if multiple people call out sick and there's no one to fill those shifts, you're going in no matter how many days in a row you worked or how many hours.
And if I may follow up. And is it the 3/12s 1 week, 4/12s the next week, so that's 36 hours and 48 hours. Is that straight time, or is that 8 hours plus you get overtime?
No.
It's all straight time?
No, it's not all straight time. It's 76. As long as you are actually working in those days and it's not sick time, it's 76 hours of straight time, 8 hours of overtime is how it works for our schedules.
Okay. Thank you so much for your details. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Additional questions from the committee for Ms. Condell?
I have a question.
Representative Freer.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Condell, you mentioned that you work 12-hour shifts and 3 weeks on. How many dispatchers are typically on in one shift?
So how it works is we're supposed to have days staffed at 6 and 6, and nights are supposed to be 5 and 5. Because we're so short-staffed, that's not what's happening. Right now, Steph's side is staffed at 6, my side is staffed at 5, and both night shifts are at 4. Our bare minimum people that can be on any shift is 4, with our intended minimum always at 5 on days because of the call volume. So that means once anyone on night shift calls out sick ever, has a hardship, is on vacation, it's automatic mandatory overtime if someone doesn't take it voluntarily.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no further questions from the committee, thank you very much, Ms. Condell, for your time and for your testimony. And Ms. Condell, Ms. Wolf, and Ms. Kalwara, if you have written testimony that you were reading from, would you please present that, email that to my office, and we will share it with the committee. With that, I'd like to turn from invited testimony over to committee discussion, if there is any. Is there any committee questions, discussion on this topic on HJR 38? Representative Colomb?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So I asked the question about the percentage of females because I think it's an important point, and I think that's why the resolution is really important. So this started with women that were on the telephone walls, right? And it kind of evolved into this position, and now 100 years later, it's complicated, it's intense, there's a lot of technology, and the majority of the career is still women. And so it kind of perked my interest when they've been classified clerical, which I did not know that. I assumed that they were first responders. So I appreciate the testimony today and just appreciate the hardship that they go through to try to help our community and those in trouble. And I think this is an important resolution just to make sure the profession is elevated. It's not a telephone operator. It's not a clerical position. And I appreciate our first responders in the field tackling these issues. But this job is very important partner to saving people in emergency situations.
Thank you, Representative Colomb, and I thought your question was very astute and apt, and it's part of, I think, a very necessary and important part of this conversation. Thank you. Additional comments or questions or discussion from the committee? Okay. Seeing none, we will set this bill over for consideration next week, and we're going to set an amendment deadline of next Wednesday, March 11th at 5 p.m. So if you have an amendment, please submit it to our office by Wednesday, March 11th at 5 p.m. Seeing no further business before the committee, this concludes our business for today. The House Labor and Commerce Committee will meet next on Monday of next week. I believe that's March 9th. This meeting is adjourned at 4:06 p.m.